On our film reviews tonight, two people in search of themselves, one in Longford, the other in Seoul, and a band of space crusaders, rooted squarely in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, set out on their third adventure. In Lakelands, a young Longford man faces an identity crisis when an assault threatens all he holds dear. A young woman born in South Korea but adopted by a French family reconnects with her blood relatives in David Chu's return to Seoul. And yet more dancing space trees and souped-up music from the 1980s. We'll give our tuppence worth on the third instalment of Guardians of the Galaxy. Ruth Barton and Justin McGregor have been to the cinema for us and they join me now in studio. We'll begin tonight with Lakelands. That's the debut film from Robert Higgins and Patrick McGivney. The film is set in Granard, County Longford, and stars Aina Hardwick, who Sean spoke to last week. He plays Kian, a farmer and star player in the local GAA club, whose life falls apart when injury disrupts his way of life. Ruth, where is Kian in his life when we first meet him?
He's a young man. As you say, he's working on the farm with his father, who's played magnificently by Lorcan Cranitch. Lorcan's kind of grisly and he's a really kind of miserable soul, but at the heart of it, he's a decent guy. So he's living there. His mother has died. Ikean's mother has died in the past, and so he's living there on his own with his father, and his whole life is really entwined with the local GAA club. He's the captain of the local football team. And as a result, this gives him a certain standing in the small town, which is Granard, but it's not really identifiable. And then he's a bit of a lad as well. So instead of going home and having a nice cup of tea after his football training, he goes to the pub with the lads. And this is where it all goes wrong, because on a night out, really randomly, he falls into a fight with a group of young fellas, and he gets kicked in the head. And as a consequence, he suffers from concussion. He thinks it isn't too serious at the beginning, goes back to everything he's been doing. But of course, it turns out that it's much more serious than he'd realised. And the doctor advises him that he must give up football. And this is the crisis of the film, because in a small town, in rural Ireland, your identity is so firmly tied into your position within the Gaelic club.
Yes, because Justin, his existence seems so simple. It's like he has the drudgery of farm work, but he enjoys it. He seems very good with animals. His father is, gruff, as Ruth has described him. But then he has the joy of the football and the lads, and he's a bit of a bowl boy with the lads. And that seems to satisfy him.
Yeah, no, it starts out very showing his daily routine very meticulously. You get to see him feed the cows. But as you said, there's this really nice touch that he's really, really good with the animals. I know we reviewed a movie here before called Cow, which is about the reality of the big factory farming. And this is very different. This is a family farm. The animals are named. They know who the animals are. There's even an issue with one of the cows is going to go to the factory, to be slaughtered. And he's quite upset by it. So we get to see this whole routine and the GAA. And then, there's this a sequence of events always after GAA that they always have one too many. The coach is always trying to stop them from having one too many. And one night it goes wrong. And that night, by the way, is done really, really well. They go into a nightclub. There's no sound. There's just this music playing. And we see it kind of happening. And then the fight sort of transpires outside. So yeah, he's very content. He really enjoys his standing in the community. And that's what he can't give up. He doesn't want to acknowledge that he has this invisible injury, which a concussion is. Isn't mature enough yet to come to terms with the consequences of what's happened.
Yeah, it's interesting, because then what happens is he starts being replaced on the football team, perhaps even replaced on the farm.
Yes, he and this is a part of the crisis, that he sees his other self almost. He's doing all the things like a kind of uncanny double. And the only thing that's going to redeem him, and I think this is one of the very nice touches of this film, is the return of an old girlfriend, Grace, who's played fantastically by Danielle Galligan. And he and she had a bit of a thing going on in the past. However, she's a nurse. She went to London. She's now in a relationship, as she tells him, with a doctor. And what's nice about the film is that it understands that they can still be friends. And so he's able to confide in her, and he's kind of stuck with a kind of masculinity that doesn't like saying that it's in trouble. So only he can only really tell her until he breaks down at home one night. And so and she's got her own problems. She's nursing her father, who is clearly, you know, an old alcoholic who her mother left him, and she said, you know, she was right to do so. So they sort of come together in mutual sympathy with each other.
Well, let's listen to a clip. Cian sees Danielle Gilligan, that's Grace, at the local pub after she has returned, as you say, from England.
Thought we'd lost you to the English.
Cian Riley, still an armchair Republican, I see.
When did you get back?
Last week.
You back for long? A
couple of weeks anyway. How's all with you?
Grand, holding down the fort, sure. What are you drinking?
Gin and tonic, if you can get through the mosh pit.
Sean, pint and a G&T when you're ready.
Well, do you have to be on the football team to get a drink around here? Is that it?
Doesn't hurt anyway.
Jesus, you were in the wars again.
Couple of lads jumping Friday night.
Really?
You should see the other lads.
Oh, yeah?
Not a scratch on.
Thank you.
I got this.
I changed my pounds at the airport. You're grand.
Well, a few lads are in. Fancy joining?
I can't. It's Siobhan's birthday. Haven't seen her in about 5 years, so it might be bad form to bail.
Well, you know where we are.
Mm. You haven't changed a bit.
Ina Hardwick there as Cian and Danielle Gilligan as Grace. Ina Hardwick, as in every scene in the film, like, he really has to carry it. And it is a fairly simple story. As you say, the fight scene in the pub is done very well, but it's not it's violent, but it's not like a gory scene.
No.
And so it's a very even paced film. Does that have its own challenges for the central character played by Ina?
I think so. I mean, it really it unfolds more than happens. You know, there's no big monologue. There's no incredibly dramatic moment. It's just kind of that the sequence of events that lead to these decisions that lead to people growing up. And the way it follows them, they just use the handheld in just a way that there's almost, especially at the beginning, a very documentary feel about it. And he is the central character. He never leaves the film. You know, there's no subplot or secondary plot. It's really about this. These other things are happening, but it's about him getting through this. And as Ruth said, a really lovely affection between these two people that didn't fall in love. And I think, you know, in a Hollywood film, they would rekindle and then have to reject it. But it's just handled so maturely. He has a line he always keeps saying, "I don't mean like that. Like, would you like come over? I don't mean like that." And it's really lovely. It's a really lovely, mature friendship. And that mature friendship helps him kind of mature in these other areas of his life, which is really, really well done.
Ruth, there is a long period of the film, though, isn't there, where we all know that he should do something about the concussion, that he is suffering silently, but he's afraid of the implications of him admitting to concussion. But that, does that make it, like, is that a difficult watch? You know, is that very slow? Is that almost too slow?
I think there is a problem with this, and you hear it in that clip, his very laconic, very disengaged delivery. And he's, you know, he's always got the quick quip, but he's not going to give us too much of himself. And this isn't because he's not a good actor. This is what he's been directed to do. But it slows down the film. And as Justin said, there's nothing to distract us from his story. The secondary characters are not really developed. They're simply the lads. And I missed, you know, those lads would have been much wittier. There would have been a lot of banter between them in real life. The script doesn't give them that. So I think that it's extreme linearity. Its intention of getting him from the beginning through to the end does make it a little thin.
Now, as you said, Lorcan Cranage plays his father, Dermot, and he is pretty grumpy, pretty monosyllabic, a kind of classic old farmer role.
It's like old 80s Irish cinema,
yeah,
isn't
it? Like Tom Reardon.
Flashback moments with him. I mean, it's not an old-fashioned film in other ways, but it has its roots, yeah, in the 80s.
Well, in this clip, we see another side to Dermot, where he takes some care of Cian and suggests that he might need a rest.
I'll be home for coming down tomorrow.
Hmm?
For what?
I was thinking you could do with a bit of a rest.
Why?
Because I couldn't finish the fence yesterday?
Well, not just that. But I can't be picking up the slack for two.
Who's coming down?
Johnny Clark's young flop. It's only for a couple of days. Did he feel up to it again?
I'm feeling up to it now. Seriously, I can take care of my own fucking farm.
Look, this is not up for discussion. You can tell yourself whatever you like, but you are nowhere near 100%.
Fuck this. There's a lot of bollocks.
Strong language there from Ina Hardwick in that clip from Lakelands, and Lorcan Cranage plays his father. So stars out of five from you, Justin, for Lakelands.
No, I really enjoyed it. It's a really good debut. And it's a side of Ireland that doesn't make it onto the screen as often as certainly I'd like. And its understanding of the GAA and its role in the community is really just sort of really well handled. So I gave it 4.5. That was very good.
4.5 out of five. And from you, Ruth?
I was a little bit meaner because of that kind of slowness and the sort of lack of evolution in the character. But I think, I mean, I agree on the GAA. It's like the church now. You know, it's taking place of the church in the community. I gave it 3.5.
3.5. That's for Lakelands. Now, next up, Return to Seoul. Park Jimin plays Freddie, a young Korean woman who takes an impulse trip to South Korea, having grown up in France with adoptive French parents, and then goes in search of her birth parents. So, Justin, this is a phenomenon, this was it post the Korean War or post what, that people, young people were adopted?
Yeah, no, it seemed to be in like the sort of early 80s. I don't know if it was the economic situation, but Korea was changing a lot. And it was still very taboo, I guess, to have children under certain circumstances. And there was this sort of institutional adoption set up. We meet this corporation really called Hammond that was sort of in charge of handling it all. And a great many of them went to France, including the director, who was born in France but comes from that background. And he had a friend who had gone through a story a bit similar to this. And so based the film Return to Seoul on this person's life. So it takes Freddie. She's just kind of arrived. We don't really know why she's there. She's being sort of very mysterious. And of course, we begin to realize she doesn't quite know why she's there. She has this sort of impulse to go and find her roots, but she hasn't really worked out all the details. So we get these sort of four chapters in her life. There's sort of these big jumps. One's of 5 years, one's of two, one's of 1 year. And we get to see her at her different stages, growing up in a very different way from Kian in Lakelands. But we get to see her kind of going on this journey, and it's reconnecting with her Korean family, with even understanding her own Koreanness. When she arrives, she only speaks French. And she meets two people who also speak French, and they kind of are translating for her. And so there's this really great play of languages where somebody says something in French, we get the subtitle in English, and then a Korean person says it in Korean and we get another subtitle in English. But they're never quite exact. If you speak French, there's little deviations in what she says in French, what the subtitle is, and then how that's translated culturally into the Korean language. And it's just a fascinating sort of play on these languages and represent, I think, Freddie's confusion of finding this precision in her own life.
And Freddie herself, Ruth, is not an easy character.
Oh, no. She's no Hollywood star, Freddie. Actually, it's fantastic. Fantastically well performed, and it's a first-time actor. Many of the people in the film are not professional actors, and the Park Jimin isn't. But she's not somebody you're ever going to like very much. She's headstrong, she's rude, and in a very ritualized society where right at the beginning, they're sitting in a bar and she's reaching to refill her glass, and her Korean host say, no, you can't. We have to pour for you. So she immediately pours for herself, reaches and knocks back the glass, and she bangs her way through this film, knocking people to right and left. But at the same time, you know, you kind of get her as well. You get that she's feeling deeply lost. And this is her response, is this sort of hostility to feeling really lost, to really having to question who she is and to which culture she belongs. And she's, you know, she's been tossed from one culture to the other, from side to side as she moves through the story.
And Justin, how does she talk about her and her father, first of all, her birth father? He's the first person she connects with, and that doesn't go well.
You know, we discovered that there's a system at Hammond that you can have all your records, but in terms of contact, they can send a telegram, they can send three in a year, and if there's no reply, that's kind of it, there's no connection. So one of the things we're waiting for in the film is for both parents to reply, and the father does reply first, and he is tormented by giving Freddie up. He's alcoholic, he's drinking a lot. Once he reconnects with her, he's kind of almost bullying her with texts and constantly trying to get in touch with her. She's kind of having a bit of an affair one night, and he's there outside her apartment drunk, sort of waiting for her. So it's very difficult. She can't quite handle the grief that they're feeling on her behalf. And as Ruth said, she has this kind of defense mechanism of just destroying things, knocking things over. But she can't actually knock over this Korean family. They are unrelenting in sort of wanting to include her in their world.
And her connection, not that that was successful, but her efforts to get in contact with her mother are more, her birth mother are more problematic.
Even more so, because her birth mother, the three telegrams go to the birth mother and she doesn't respond. And after that, Hammond Central says, the adoption agency says, that's it, we can't get in contact with her again. So it's only later on, and 8 years, as Justin says, pass in the time span of the film. So it's only in the final part of it that one of the adoption agency employees decides to slightly renegotiate the rules and says, yeah, I've put you in touch with your mother. And in one incredibly moving scene, she's reunited just once with her mother. And then something goes wrong, and I won't say what it is. And it all falls apart again. But her mother brings out in her, we know from the beginning that she's musical and that she plays the piano, but she never performs throughout the film until the very end. And it's like, oh, her mother's brought this out in her again, this talent. Because, of course, one of the things the adopted child wants to know is, how did I get my talents? How did I get my personality? And I suspect, you know, having seen the fairly miserable side of the family that her father represents, she really wants her mother to be great. And then her mother lets her down as well. But the musicality and that sort of, you know, artistic temperament seem to come from the mother.
And do we get any sense of that uneasiness she has in life and that bull in a china shop way she has in life? Do we get any sense of the genetic source of that?
Not so much. Well, I mean, obviously the parents have made a bit of a mess of her life and have really wanted her to have a good life, but now also want her to come back. But yes, she does. I think the great thing about the time shifts is she's more aware in each shift. And I think it's in the second shift, she says, or the third shift, she says, soul is toxic for me, to her boyfriend, stay near me. But that awareness doesn't stop her from then destroying that. You know, it's really sort of quite remarkable. So we get to know her and she gives us just enough that we're really sympathetic, like she's becoming self-aware, but she just kind of can't help herself. And we can't help but be sympathetic because the origin of it is what happened to her, you know, so shortly after her birth.
But it sounds like a very brave representation of the whole.
It is. And it's a really interesting kind of debate about nature nurture as well, because she's obviously been adopted by quite a wealthy, privileged and cultured French family. So she's actually kind of socially in a different class to the family, that particularly the father's family. So there are all these layers within the film as to what's better for her. You know, would she have been better in this kind of fairly miserable background? Has she actually benefited from this French absorption in French culture? And you know, where will she end up, I think? It's anyone's guess.
So for Return to Seoul from you, Justin, how many stars?
Yeah, no, as Ruth said, the scene where she meets her mother, and there's a scene that takes place, the second last scene, on a toilet that is absolutely heartbreaking as Freddie goes to the toilet and something happens. And it's just it's a fascinating film. You really have no idea what's going to happen next in a very legitimate way, you know. And so I give it 4.5. Really excellent.
4.5. You're so generous tonight. Well, what yeah. about you?
I was slightly Great. Less generous again. I gave it 4, though. I thought it was fantastic. Yeah,
great.
It was really
that's from bright. That's from Return to Seoul. And finally, to the latest release from MCU, that's the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, lands on our screens this weekend in a blaze of 80s music and zingy dialogue. Ruth, This is the third Guardians of the Galaxy, and of course they sometimes appear in other Marvel movies.
I'm just really hoping you're not going to ask me to tell you what happens, because
you might just set it up. There are kind of two stories going
there
on.
There surely are, yeah. And then we know from the start this is the final one of this Guardians of the. This is volume three, is the last volume in the series of this particular outing. There will no doubt be spin-offs from the other characters. So what this is going to do is it's going to pick up a story, and the story is actually quite straightforward. Our guardians live on Planet Nowhere, which is this giant hollowed-out skull. One of the kind of chief guardians is Rocket Raccoon. And then this other planet...
Who is a raccoon. And that's voiced by Bradley Cooper.
So one of the other planets... sends a mission to Planet Nowhere, and Rocket Raccoon gets very, very seriously injured in the ensuing fight. And there's a fight every 10 minutes or so. But instead of being able to revive him quickly with, you know, their technology, it turns out that something's been implanted in him that they have to find a spare part by going to the planet where he came from and fixing him. And there's no other way of getting him back to life again. So they go on a mission to this other planet, which is ruled over by the High Evolutionary. And the High Evolutionary is the mad scientist of the story, and he's been tampering with animals in order to create a new perfect world called Counter Earth. So they have to go there, retrieve the missing piece, fix Rocket, and end the story.
Oh, well, that makes it very simple.
Emotionally end the story as well as get to the end of the adventure.
All right, but Mike Lipp has nothing to do with that now. Oh, no. It's got Chris Pratt as Quill, and he's trying to reconnect with some old girlfriend. Can you give me some context for that?
Yes, so in one of the Avengers movies, his girlfriend was killed, but his girlfriend also was brought forward through time to the present, and that version of her exists, but of course never fell in love with Peter. So he's still obsessed with, you know, he can obviously see his girlfriend right there, but they've never had a relationship, and she doesn't have any memories of their relationship. So he's sort of trying to woo her at the same time, and he's been in a bit of a funk while
all
this is going on.
And I think that's happening in this, and then the other guardians give their tuppence halfpenny.
And I miss you so much. And maybe if you open yourself up to it, there's a possibility.
I don't think so, Quinn.
Quill.
I don't think so.
Well, what I'm trying to say is...
Peter, you know this is an open line, right?
What?
We're listening to everything you're saying.
And it is painful.
And you're just telling me now?
We were hoping it would stop on its own.
But I switched it over to private.
What color button did you push?
Blue, for the blue suit.
Oh, no.
Blue is the open line for everyone.
Orange is for blue.
What?
Black is for orange. Yellow is for green. Green is for red. And red is for yellow.
No, yellow is for yellow. Green is for red. Red is for green.
I don't think so.
Try it then.
Hello! You were right.
So that was Chris Pratt as Quill, Zoe Saldana as Glamora, and then we heard Clive as Mantis, Davis Bautista as Drac, and Karen Gillan as Nebula. I thought Ruth explained, set up the scene very well.
Thank you.
And we see there that there's lots of humour. Is humour that works in this, you know, very dramatic and, well, maybe action flick?
Yeah, no, I mean, he kind of has like a rotation. There's an action scene, there's a comic scene, there's an emotional scene, and then there's an 80s music scene, and then it gets repeated. And I'm not saying the formula doesn't work. It works very well. It's very entertaining. And then, though, there's this flashback to Rocket's origins, which is much more like a horror film. James Gunn, the director, comes from, you know, Romeo and Juliet, which was a horror film done with Trauma Studios, and he's kind of gone back to that. So he has all these modified animals. There's a walrus with wheels. There's a bunny rabbit with spider's legs, and there's an otter with these spindly arms. And that is less funny than the bits with the humans.
All right, so this is this evolutionary doctor has created these people, or animals with great powers, but things have gone a bit awry.
Yes, and Rocket is his greatest achievement, and that's why he's trying to get Rocket back, because Rocket could think creatively and all of his other creations just think by rote. And so that's sort of the motivation underneath. But it moves back and forth between these kind of set pieces with the Guardians and then does these flashbacks that are quite creepy and very, very dark. I think it'd have a higher age limit, perhaps, than some of the other Guardians movies.
And James Gunn is the director, but he got into some trouble about tweets and lost his job for a while.
Yes, no, after the second one came out, they found some tweets that he was trying to be a stand-up comedian at one point and had done some tweets that, you know, were quite offensive. And so Disney fired him. But the rest of the cast, there was a bit of an uprising, especially Dave Bautista, who was like, look, everyone thought this movie the first one was going to be a disaster. It made very, very good money. And so eventually they brought him back. But by the time they brought him back, DC Cinematic Universe had scooped him up to rescue their offering, which is not doing as well as the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But he agreed to come back for this one last kind of go. So there's a very sentimental side to the film, because he's the writer as well, where he's saying goodbye. The characters will be back, but he's sort of sending them off into the sunset the way that he really wants to.
All right. So overall, Ruth, what did you think, and how many stars?
Well, I found it excessively long, because it seemed to me to have two endings. One was the ending to the adventure story, and then the second was this, just this very sentimental sort of tie up when we're saying goodbye to all the characters. So too long, too many characters, too many cameos. Sylvester Stallone pops up in one cameo, and you have these kind of celeb cameos. On the other hand, I can see his love for his characters coming through, and I think it's very entertaining. So I gave it 3.5.
3.5 from Ruth, and from you, Justin.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's very much for the fans. It is this kind of, sort of like the end of Lord of the Rings, you know, there's this sort of extended set pieces of him saying goodbye. Though I will admit the very last credit is Star-Lord will return, just in case, you know, anybody is worried. So I thought 3.5 stars, and I'm sure fans will like it more. It is, it's very funny, it's very entertaining. But it did feel longer than the other films, in not in a great way, but still very good.
Well, 3.5 from Ruth Barton and Justin McGregor for Guardians of the Galaxy. Lakelands and Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 go on general release this weekend, and Return to Seoul goes on limited release. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. Claire Kilroy's writing has been lauded since the publication of her debut novel, All Summer. Since then, she has written Tenderwire, All Names Have Been Changed, and The Devil I Know. It's been 10 years since she last published, and therein lies a tale, which in many respects is revealed in her new novel, Soldier Sailor, the story of a woman trying to navigate between being a mother for the first time. The novel opens ominously with the mother, Soldier, telling her young baby, Sailor, that all is well for now. I'm delighted to be joined by Claire Kilroy. Claire, I think you said that this was your most personal novel to date. And how big a disruption did having a baby cause in your life and in your literary life?
It kind of ended it. There's no nice way about it. I call it the baby-shaped hole. It just blew me out of the water. So that is the reason why there has been this huge gap in my publishing career. It certainly wasn't because I took a break or wanted to not write for a while. Because I actually was working away on it from, I'd say he was about 6 months old, and I was trying to piece bits together, you know, because it's so, if you're a writer, you're doing it because you need to. You know, you're not doing it because you've an employer paying you. You're doing it because that's how you are in the world. So, you know, I was trying the whole time. But motherhood's a state of constant interruption. You know, you really can't do much when you have a child or a baby with you. So it's it's very, it's some women have managed it, you know, managed it well. And I realized I was turning that into another stick to beat myself with, that, you know, I'm not managing to write a novel and raise a child and then have 10 more, you know. And I decided I'm not going to beat myself up over that, because there's so many other ways that mothers in particular beat themselves up. But I couldn't do the whole multitasking thing of writing while being screamed at. And
yes, because you decided to be a full-time mother.
I wouldn't say I decided it. I wouldn't, you know, there's logistical and financial considerations to do with cost of childcare, and it's not subsidised in this country. Things are improving, but it's not subsidised. So you have to buy your time by either paying a childminder or a creche. So if you're an artist of any kind or anyone unsalaried, you get into very tricky terrain. So no, I did not. No one was more surprised than me to be a full-time mother. Retrospectively, I'm glad. You know, I'm glad. I know it was actually a great privilege to spend that time with my boy. And but at the time, it wasn't. I think the best. Every mother has a different optimal situation, and for me, the optimal situation would be to do some writing and some childcare.
So we'll discuss the real life and the novel as we go along, but introduce us to Soldier and Sailor.
Sailor is the baby. Sailor, I was clear that I wanted to write the preschool years. So it starts with Sailor at the beginning. He's only maybe about 2 months old. He's a baby. And by the end of it, he's working up to going to school. So I just wanted to go into the nuts and bolts of what this is, you know, and it's so intense. There's a lot of logistics in it. The second chapter is a day in the life of wrangling a baby around the place. By then, in the second chapter, he's able to crawl. Once they crawl, it's like, oh, because they're you know, it's like herding cats. So it's just going into a day at home with a child and what it takes to keep a child alive. And it moves on for that. The sailor grows up, and actually so does his mother, Soldier, because it is, we sort of have these protracted adolescence now. We're free until, you know, I hadn't understood freedom until I lost it. So when you become a mother, you become responsible. And all the business of your previous life, you realise what a privilege that was.
Now, the book is action-packed, believe it or not, even though it's a very domestic setting a lot of the time. And I think the opening section of the book really confronts our primal fears about being a parent, and that need, you know, not the fear that our baby might be taken, but that you might actually be driven to abandoning the child, a bit like some old folkloric story about abandonment. But bring us into that space, which is one of the most frightening scenarios in the book.
That is the opening. That's early motherhood, which is it's such a wild time. It's a comment that's in the book. The most kind of off-grid time of your life is domestic. And if this is domestic, you know, I think we need a new word for domestic. But you're so sort of sleep deprived and think deprived in those days that your mind can go into all sorts of strange places. And I wrote, the first thing I wrote after having my boy was a short essay in Winter Papers. And it was about the logic in my mind when I did get into my head that I needed to abandon my baby because that was the best thing for his welfare, because I was in such a state that it would impact him negatively. And thankfully, I did not go down that road. But it became the starting point for the novel. What if you did go down that road, as mothers have gone down that road? What happens then? And that's where it began. It began in that difficult place. And it moves towards, the kids grow up, you know, and things get easier, it gets happier.
And Claire, you wrote this in this state of you didn't write it, but you were in the state of chaos, you know, as, you know, trying to bring up a child, finding it difficult. How did you then, did you write it all retrospectively? Or as you said, you did make attempts to take notes. Like, how did you create this beautifully structured book out of the chaos of your life?
I had this file, as I do now. I have notes 6 because I'm working on a 6th novel. But, you know, the first novel was notes 1, notes 2, notes 3. So I had a file called notes 5, which is a notes file, just anything goes into notes. And so I was making observations and jotting down feelings. And all the time I was trying to put something in the notes file. So then that's the chaos, you know, this huge sprawling file that's out of control, and I don't know where it starts and I don't know where it ends and I don't know if there is a novel, you know. But you have to, the one thing I've learned from the other 4 novels is that it does turn into a novel once you apply the craft of writing and structuring. So, you know, I was working off this file of notes and took that as my starting point, because that's when the baby was it follows the track of the child, baby to about 4. But yeah, the notes were written as it was happening, but it was, you know, that Wordsworthian thing of powerful emotions recollected in tranquility. The crafting of it happened afterwards.
Right. And the book is a conversation, an ongoing conversation between a soldier, the mother, and sailor, the boy. And then there always has to be a baddie. And the daddy is a kind of a baddie. He's a bit feckless. He's living in his own galaxy, as soldier says. And the dynamic there between a soldier and the father is, it gives the book a lot of humour, but also a lot of truth, I think.
Yeah, there tends to be in relationships, one person ends up doing the care and the other person ends up not doing the care. And that is reflected in a lot of conversations I've had with a lot of mothers. And indeed, sometimes if the mother is the main breadwinner, it's the other way around. The father ends up doing more. So it is that who does this work, you know, and there is a kind of, people play chicken, who's going to answer the screaming baby, you know, and the person who folds first tends to end up doing all the childcare. So, you know, I didn't want to paint men as bad. So the possibly third most important character is a stay-at-home dad. You know, and he's parenting in a different way to a mother, but a nice way, you know, and they bounce off each other.
Yes, she meets him at a playground, this old friend of hers who now is a stay-at-home father of 3 children. And there's an easiness about him, and they have that old relationship where he knows that she was an imaginative, wonderful person, that she's not just the crazy mother.
Mm. Yeah, and that's a thread back to previous life, and it's a thread she holds on to, because a huge part of motherhood is the loss of identity, the loss of who you used to be when you were in the workplace and you were earning, you know, all of these things, and your work colleagues are gone. So she clings to that old identity, and he helps her at a difficult time.
Now, you're going to read a section, a small section from the book. I think it's quite later on in the book, but it gives that sense of how you create these spaces that mothers occupy or stay-at-home parents occupy.
Yeah, it was more the kind of misconceptions of, actually, this whole book is about the misconceptions I had and why did I have them and how was I so wrong, and essentially that mothers are people too. So just briefly, I encountered an army of mothers at pick-up outside the school that I was sussing out for you the other day. They appeared from several directions at once, around corners, down streets, out of cars. Like zombies, was my first thought as I watched them gravitate towards the school gates. Some of them were pushing buggies, others wheeled scooters. One woman carried a teddy bear. It would be a mistake to assume that because of the soft toy, the woman herself was soft. The women carrying teddy bears are the most dangerous of them all. They would kill to protect the owners of those bears. Sailor, I have been that soldier.
Claire Kilroy reading from her new novel, Soldier Sailor. We were talking about Yvonne Boland on the show not so long ago, and like that was her whole aim in her own poetry and literature was to make these stories that you are writing now of a mother and child central to literature and central to Irish literature, which was so the bailiwick of men.
It is unseen. All this work that parents, but mostly women and historically women, have been doing forever is unseen, you know, and all the stuff that is done to raise a child isn't logged in any way. So I wanted to see it, and to, that's why it goes into such detail of how hard to just get a kid out of door. So like before you are that soldier trying to get a kid out the door, you've no idea that it involves mind games and negotiation and bribes and star charts and just to get out the door, you know. It really floored me.
Yes, yeah. I love the packing of all the what you have to bring with you and the snack, and then the snack if he doesn't like the first snack.
If he throws it. You know, it is like working for the UN and they're the terrorists and you have to try and de-escalate all the time. And I guess, you know, it's grand for the first hour. Like by the time you've been at it 12 hours that day, you're worn out, you know. So, yes, it is. But also the love. You know, there's all these books about romantic love. And then when you have a child, you see this love is on a different, more epic, almost mythological scale. It's unquestioned. As I say, I've written a novel about it because it takes a novel. Well, for me, Yvonne Boland did it in poetry, but to just, you know, acknowledge the magnitude of it.
Well, indeed you did. And the name of the novel is Soldier Sailor. Claire Kilroy, thank you so much. And it's published by Faber. It's just coming up to 11 minutes to 8. If you think we needed yet another post-apocalyptic TV show, well, it's just arrived on Apple TV Plus. It's called Silo, and it's based on a series of sci-fi novels by Hugh Howey. The 10-part series stars Rebecca Ferguson and David Oyelowo, two occupants of the Silo, a massive underground bunker where it looks like the last remaining humans have been sheltering from the poisoned environment outside for a few centuries. How did they get there? What happened to the poison and who poisoned the earth and who exactly built the mile-deep retreat are the big questions that are very slowly explored in Silo. I'm joined by Chris Wasser, who's been watching Silo. Chris, can you take us through the premise of Silo, besides the fact that there's one great big bunker in the middle of it?
That's the big mystery, and you listed questions at the top there that we're not going to get any answers to anytime soon. But yes, humanity does live underground now. You have these 144 levels that go down a mile or two. You know, you've got the rich and powerful people up the top and the people who are actually keeping the lights on and everything running.
And it looks great, the bunker,
it
doesn't
does,
it?
Actually, yeah. Yeah, yeah. You've got the people who are operating it down on the bottom, so there's some interesting social commentary there. But yeah, this show is working with Apple, you know, Apple TV budget, so it does look quite effective. But our main characters, as you mentioned, Rebecca Ferguson plays this engineer Juliet, but we start with David Oyelowo's Sheriff Holston. And when we first meet him in the opening minutes, it's quite an effective opener. He is effectively reporting for duty. You know, he's on his way to work. He says hello to everybody. He stops and makes himself a coffee. And then once his deputy comes in, played by the great character actor Will Patton, he then locks himself in the cell and says, "I want to go outside." And as soon as he says this, it changes everything, because if anyone inside the Silo declares their intent to go outside, or if they question anything about the Silo's history, they don't really know much about the Silo's history, they're treated as a criminal, not of the state, but of the Silo. And they're put in these astronaut suits and they're put outside to clean. And it's almost as though the government that runs this Silo is testing the people that live there, because if you go outside, it's because you think you're being lied to. It's because you think that the atmosphere is clean. But the people who are running the Silo want you to to, you know, believe that, or they're saying anyway, that it's toxic, that something happened. We don't know what had happened, but you have to stay here. You have to keep the peace.
And is everybody in the silo pretty happy to be there? I mean, I know they fear going out.
Yeah.
But, you know, is peace and tranquility, and is everybody getting on?
It looks as though everyone's just getting by. There's this very effective, there is a cinema sized screen in every canteen on every level of the silo, and the broadcast on this screen is an image from the outside, and we see that it's just this barren wasteland. The air doesn't look too breathable, you know, everything's just grey. There are actually bodies scattered about the place of other people who went outside, you know, who said that they wanted to go outside, who were put outside to clean, and they keep this image broadcast every set. It's just always there, and it's as though it's reminding people, you're lucky to be here, you're lucky to be alive. And why did, you know, I'm going back to the sheriff, why did he want to go outside? We then start to do something that Silo, you know, does about every episode. It flips back and forth. It's sort of a Lost type narrative, and we see that at one point the sheriff was happy. He was married to Allison. She's played by Rashida Jones, and they're actually trying for a baby. And the reason I bring this story up, and it may sound as though I'm giving a lot away, but the reason I bring this story up is because it's a good indication of the rules and laws in the Silo. If you want to have a baby, you actually have to, you know, get government's permission. And then you're given a year, you know, to try, and if unsuccessful, then you're not allowed.
Yes,
to.
Yes, and you're literally on a clock.
You're on a clock that counts down, yeah, in your house every day. To be in a couple with somebody, you have to be legally sanctioned by the mayor and by, you know, these secret voters that we never see. You have to stay on your levels of the silo if you want to actually travel. If you, it's like going on holiday or something. If you want to go above or below, you have to get permission. But this mayor and his IT expert wife, Allison, they were trying for a baby. They were quite unsuccessful. And when she was actually working as an IT expert, she came across some information that led her to believe that maybe she's being lied to, that maybe life outside the silo is actually different. It's, you know, there might be something out there, and she wants to go outside, and that's what leads to.
Okay, well, that leads me into the first clip. Allison, as you said, played by Rashida Jones, and her husband, Sheriff Halston, played by David Oyelowo, have been approved to try for a baby. And as they sit down for breakfast, they are approached by Gloria, played by Sophie Thompson, a fertility expert.
I really hate this part.
People are just happy for us.
No, I just wish everyone didn't know.
Oh, shit.
Sheriff, Mrs. Becker, I don't mean to intrude.
So don't.
There's your famous tell-it-like-it-is manner. Why everyone likes you.
If everyone likes me, I'm not doing my job.
Mrs. Becker, your husband might not be interested in what I have to say.
No, what I'd really be interested in is you leaving us alone, Gloria.
Step. But whatever our sheriff may have told you, I provide fertility counseling.
Oh, yeah? Like what?
Your husband's waiting for me to say something I'm not legally allowed to say.
Such as?
Clever. I have no desire to be sent out, thank you, Sheriff. Mrs. Becker, if you've an open mind, come see me. I wish you both the very best. What does she do exactly?
She goes right to the edge of promising people a baby if they do what she says, which is fraud, and it's cruel.
So we see there, that's quite early on. Sheriff Halston is very much upstanding and defender of the laws of the silo, and yes, believes everything he's told, whereas there's this suspicion now creeping into his wife that everything may not be perfect, or maybe people are manipulating them in the silo. So where does Juliet, then played by Rebecca Ferguson, who's also an executive producer of this, come into the silo?
So she is an engineer who works down at the bottom, and she you know, she comes into contact with the sheriff because a partner of hers, who was actually looking into, you know, stuff like historical relics, people are not actually allowed, if they come across any objects from the before times, which is 140 years before the silo, they have to hand them over. If they keep them in their possession, they'll be put outside. But her partner, Juliet's partner, had come into possession of relics. He was investigating, you know, what actually happened, you know, where did this silo come from? And then he died. And mysteriously, just all of a sudden. So she is convinced, she's an engineer by day, but she's convinced at night, you know, she's investigating his death, that he was murdered. So she brings this to the sheriff, and then we start to follow her story because, you know, the sheriff actually, you know, I won't say what happens to him, but basically he starts to believe the stuff that his wife used to. If it sounds as though we're bouncing all over the place, it's because this show does. It is a little cleaner than what I've made it sound, but this was actually all dreamt up by Yue Howie initially as a short story. The first short story that Yue Howie put out in 2011 on Amazon.com, he actually put it on this self-publishing a section of their site and didn't think it would be read by anybody, but it just took off. And the first short story was actually everything that we see in the first episode here. And if I had actually read that first story, or if I had just seen this as maybe an installment of, say, Black Mirror or something like that, some sort of like sci-fi horror anthology, I'd be quite happy with that. But he started adding on other characters and adding on the rules and adding on the laws. And the show sort of plays out like that. It gives us episode by episode a different part corner of the silo, or a different, you know, a defender of the law over here. Let's look at the mayor's life. So it does require some patience. You are moving about the place. You are literally moving up and down the silo throughout the series, but the performances are quite good, and that's no surprise. I mean, Rebecca Ferguson is the lead. She is terrific here.
Yes, and there's the mayor, and then there's the Justice Department.
Yes.
So that's a rather sinister department, we think. We're not too sure how above board the mayor is, but we definitely think, and that's Tim Robbins.
Robbins comes in at one stage. We think that he is an IT expert, but there's an awful lot more to him. Common, the rapper and actor, is in there too. He, you know, at the minute he looks as though he's wandered in off the set of a Matrix film, but, you know, there's something mysterious with him. We have Ian Glen portraying a doctor character. We've got some fabulous performers in here, and a lot of different threads, but it actually works. At one stage, this story was actually going to be adapted by Ridley Scott and Steve Zahlen. Steve Zahlen, who wrote the screenplay for Schindler's List, Moneyball, The Irishman, and they were going to turn it into maybe a two and a half hour, one-off film event. I don't think that would have suited it. I think an awful lot of people were excited to see what Ridley Scott would have done with it, but it probably, for once, how many times do I actually come in here and say that a series might have worked better as a film? This definitely works better as a series. Because,
but maybe a shorter one, Chris.
Maybe a shorter one. But
like, I did feel some of them. You know, how often do they have to say, oh, I found a relic, and come look at the relic? She goes around, Rebecca Ferguson's character, Juliet, goes around to a number of people with the relic, and you think, oh, well, somebody just watched the DVD or whatever it is.
Yeah, there is that problem. Like, you know, the best sci-fi stories are the ones that keep you guessing, the ones that don't explain themselves, but they also have to establish some rules and some kind of, you know, divert their own vernacular as they go along. So it does repeat itself in that state. It's almost like it's saying to the viewers, listen, have you got all the language? Okay, now we can get on with the story. I will stick with it though, because I am so curious. I hope there are answers. I am curious, who the hell built this thing? Why are they all on the ground? Are they being lied to? Is the air breathable outside, or is it toxic? And are we going to see more of the sheriff?
Because when the people go out into the outside, they do die. But we're wondering, why are they dying? Or you think maybe they don't die?
That's the thing. And it could work well as this as a good analogy for even, like, you know, what we see at the minute. Like, everyone's watching this event, you know, unfold on a television screen together. It's almost like they're watching the news. But, you know, you don't, everything you see, you have to question as well. So you don't really know what's going on.
So you say watch Silo.
Yeah, I will stick with it. Yeah, it might require some patience, but Rebecca Ferguson, her performance actually makes it worth your while. So stick it out.
Chris Foster, thank you very much. Episode 1 and 2 of Silo are available to stream on Apple TV this Friday, that's tomorrow, with new episodes arriving weekly through to June the 30th.